the wider conversations it started to generate. When those lights go up at the end of the night and an audience leaves, the conversation doesn't stop there. To witness that, for me, that's like overwhelming. I can't think of an equivalent of that happening so quickly for a play. Everyone talks about, understandably, what this means to you in terms of your growth and how it helps you reflect on what happened. But like, I feel growth in this project as well. Like, this is not normally the kind of thing I would always write.
My name is Jacob Dunn. I'm an author, campaigner, and educator in restorative justice. In 2011, I threw a single punch that ended another man's life. And after 14 months in prison, I found myself homeless, unemployed, and struggling to find a sense of purpose. But I managed to get my life back on track, and now I help others do the same. Join me on this first season of Right From Wrong, where I speak to the people who were instrumental in my journey from punishment to redemption. This is Right From Wrong. Welcome back to the final episode of season one of Right From Wrong. It's been a journey, and it has been an honor to have you join me for the ride. We have traveled through the Meadows estate and the development of gang culture with Akai, my darkest hours of court, prison and probation with Wendy, held to account and supported with Joan whilst peeking behind the restorative justice curtain alongside Nicola. Became a geek and caught the bug for education with Derek, and restored my friendship with my brother. We also went back into prison for the right reasons with Sandra and took a deep dive into Julie and Tony's experience of sharing my story on stage in the play Punch. I can't say that I was very well versed in drama and the arts before getting approached by the Nottingham Playhouse to adapt my book. I had been to Panto a couple of times as a kid, but ran away from the thought of acting in secondary school and would eventually become drawn to a totally different type of drama. Although I did play a gangster in my primary school's production of Bugsy Malone. So it is only right that we therefore complete this season with the man responsible for turning my now not so gangster self and many of the guests we have had on the podcast into stage play characters. That man is our State of the Nation playwright and now fellow Nottingham mate, James Graham. Please welcome James to the show. James, welcome to the show. Right. Hi. From Wrong.
Cheers, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
Are you impressed with that little monologue there?
Yes, yeah, because you're a good little writer yourself, aren't you? I see. You got written a book, written a monologue.
Well, learnt from the best. I bet you're sick of the sight of me now, aren't you?
No. Although, what was it, 48 hours since we last saw each other? So it's good to have, you know, step away and then come back. You know, you get so close, don't you, when you're making a play? You have to. And I, considering I was telling your story, I think that's probably the most kind of intimate collaboration as you can have as a couple of writers.
Mm. As you alluded to, we're now 4 days after the final show of Punch. We had a little night out after the final night. How do you feel about how everything's gone?
I'm just really touched and relieved. I mean, it's, I think with every piece of art you ever make, whether it's a TV drama or a stage play, the first feeling you get to when you open is you just want to get away with it. You're just like relief. It's like, I hope this doesn't destroy me at a bare minimum, my reputation, my self-esteem. And then when it starts to go quite well, you start to get really overwhelmed and like really touched with how it was connecting with an audience. And this play in particular, because of your story and what it seems to do to people, to an audience live in a theatre, the fact that it's my hometown, it's the first full-length play I've ever written for my community, which meant a huge amount. The reaction it got, not just from critics, although that's nice and may puffs you up a little bit, the reaction from crowds standing on their feet every night, but the wider conversations it started to generate, and I know you facilitated that, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in terms of how you, when those lights go up at the end of the night and an audience leaves, the conversation doesn't stop there. To witness that, for me, an audience coming out of that and talking, and you know, judges telling offenders to go and see it, members of parliament raising it in the House of Commons, that's like overwhelming. I can't think of an equivalent of that happening so quickly for a play. I remember back to the very beginning of this process when we started talking about, do you remember all the way back, we were like, is it a one-man show? Should we just have Jacob on stage? Do we include other characters? Can we? Should we? Is it right to include David and Joan as characters? If we are going to do that, what's the responsible, sensitive way to do that? Not just in terms of on stage, but process, because, you know, it feels like the way you describe it, it's a journey, not a destination, that you're still going on, the healing and the work, and that includes your journey with David and Joan. And I'm more conscious now than I was previously, that in a small way, that even this play was like one of the next steps of your relationship with them in terms of processing what happened and doing that with 700 people a night rather than just on your own.
And at the end of that restorative justice meeting, you know, we say that we're going to agree to try and raise awareness.
Mm.
And then you are, you know, helping us do that.
Yeah,
it's kind of meta,
doesn't it? Like, the thing that you're talking about on stage becomes a thing that the audience are watching
and doing.
And they were all a part of. And so it's, really incredible. And I'm still sort of processing the value of that. And everyone talks about, understandably, what this means to you in terms of your growth and how it helps you reflect on what happened. But like, I feel growth in this project as well. Like, this is not normally the kind of thing I would always write. I do quite, I don't know, like pompous, sometimes political, like public characters like Rupert Murdoch, or I did a drama about Dominic Cummings, with which Benedict Cumberbatch played, or the Coffin Major trial on television. Like, these are big stories, but in terms of the things that affected me in your story about class and regionality and masculinity and vulnerability and relationships with people, there was like, that was like trigger for me. And I was like, oh my God, why is this getting under my skin so much? But it was remarkable for me.
You nodded to the other pieces of work that you've written and the stories that you've explored in the past. Did you always intend to be a writer?
I think I always knew I wanted to do something creative, but like you, like I went to pantos as a kid, but I didn't really, like, theatre and culture wasn't a massive part of my life. Different from you, you were like proper Nottingham city centre. I grew up in the north of the county, sort of the mining villages at the very top of Nottinghamshire, almost on the Yorkshire border. This will sound like a plug, but if anyone's seen Sherwood on BBC One, it's a drama I've been working on. That's that community that I grew up in. And, you know, post-industrial, working class, but sort of a sense of, as we said, a line in the show, like aspirational working class, that people took pride in their work and felt real pain and the loss of dignity when that work got taken away. So it was I loved it, but a tough place to grow up and a tough time to grow up with what was happening. So I remember often spending like loads of time in my own head. I would get like A4 bits of paper and fold them over into a fake book and write a title on the front page and start writing stories and drawing pictures. So I always knew that I really loved making stuff up and processing the world that way.
Ashfield,
yep.
Nottingham. I'd just like to touch on a little bit more about your aspirational working class upbringing and the parallels in Punch. So parents divorced like mine. Mm-hmm. You had a better experience in school because you found the arts. You had a supportive drama teacher. Is that unusual for a rural mining town to be heavy on the arts?
Yeah, I mean, apart from that one famous Billy Elliot kid, I think it's it is unusual. And although actually, I think about this a lot, like it didn't used to be back in my day, another line from the play. But, you know, back in the, whenever I talk to my parents or aunties and uncles, like culture in mining communities, particularly through working men's clubs or miners' welfares, live music, painting classes, writing classes, adult learning, that used to be like the fabric of the community. And people didn't associate the arts and culture with like highfalutin elite middle class stuff. It was part of working class life and people took great pride in it. And I guess the hollowing out of that public realm a bit in the 80s and the 90s when the industry's closed, but other political changes, we're just more isolated as a community. There's less places for people to gather together and be a physical community. So culture's gone a bit. And actually the school play in a comprehensive school is probably almost one of the rare occasions when everyone in the community gets to go and sit in a space together because they're bullied too by the kids, but also it's a reason to leave your house. And so I think it was unusual. And also, like, to say it out loud, there's an association, isn't there, with the arts, that it's quite soft, quite namby-pamby, get called gay if we're doing a play. And I guess in those more traditional, socially conservative communities, sometimes it can be a default cruelly amongst younger lads to go, what are you doing that for? Why don't you just kick a ball like a normal person?
But you never felt that?
No, I mean, I felt it a bit, but actually, I think that's what the school was successful at doing. They created a philosophy where it was cool. Like, I remember that my drama teacher got the head of the football team to play Romeo and that kind of thing. And it felt just like, it's not rocket science, but you have to have a culture that encourages it.
And it comes down to kind of like being comfortable in your own skin, yeah. which is difficult in those teenage years, isn't it? When you've got all those pressures of fitting in socially or...
Yeah, well, definitely. And it's performative, isn't it? You're trying to present yourself and therefore work out yourself. But yeah, whilst you're forming in the fires of teenage life, it's all that stuff's really vulnerable. But yeah, apart from other difference you mentioned, like you grew up in a very urban environment in the city, mine was more rural, quiet, and there were fields and maybe a stronger sense of a specific work ethic in one particular industry.
And we've spoke about your mum, and I had the honour of meeting her on press night.
She thought you were a proper celebrity. She was like gushing over you. Yeah,
but yeah, she was. She was also a big part in that kind of giving you those aspirational.
Yeah, I think so. My mum and my dad were. They both sort of worked hard and pushed us at school. But I think there was also in the aspirational working classness of things, there was like a lot of my wider family didn't have as regular employment, and a lot of them benefit class couldn't struggle to sort of find work. And I think in a way we were, and you talk about this in your story, I think in our family we were seen as like the posh ones, even though compared to the world, not remotely posh, but our family we were seen as being sort of la-di-da. Like my mum worked three jobs, full-time day job, worked in a warehouse in the evening and then in a corner shop at the weekend to give money for us to do hobbies and things, give my brother an instrument, give me and my sister stuff. And in a way, so yeah, we were seen as, I guess, keeping up with the Joneses kind of, maybe even judged a bit, like getting above our station, like stay in your lane.
I can kind of relate to that. Yeah, we just know the extra activities, although with my mum, it came at the expense of a bit of debt on the credit card, it was all kind of that in the good faith, aspiring
exactly.
for more.
Yeah.
Well, you've been labelled the State of the Nation playwright. What does the State of the Nation playwright mean?
I don't know. I mean, it's not my phrase, and I'm obviously flattered, and it's nice that people think. I guess what people interpret it as being is as a writer, me and other writers who enjoy grappling with the here and now in our country, and actually specifically Britain and what it's like to grow up here and what we've been going through, particularly in the slightly crazy period that we've all just lived through as a country. We're in a moment, this country, of transition from whatever happened in post-financial collapse and post-Brexit and during austerity. And, you know, we've been reeling with a prime minister every hour and I feel like in that existential moment, it feels like any artist, any writer should be contributing some story. And we don't have any more authority to do that than anyone else. Like, I don't know any more about British life and our institutions any more than anyone else. But my job allows me to go off and explore and research and hang out in the House of Commons or hang out in a newspaper office or other environments that I put on stage and try and make sense of our institutions and our powers and why the systems and processes that govern us and run us operate the way that they do.
Yeah, I heard you say the minor details reveal the greatest truths.
That was clever of me. I don't remember saying that, I agree with it.
Was that the case for Punch? And more broadly, because what I get from that statement is that's how you get into the culture of a place, or how you understand a character or a place.
But also like find meaning in it. Like you... So this house was a place set in the House of Commons in the 70s, and all of my questions when I first went there wasn't about what is democracy and what's it, and like it was like, where do you park and where do you get your lunch and do you share an office, do you get to pick your own office, or does someone give you that office? If they do give you that office, why, what's that about? And and you don't know what you're looking for, you just know that it's like, I guess, coding in software. You go in that granular detail must reveal a wider plan, a theme, an idea, a philosophy about what governs us. And I think it probably was the same with you. I probably started off really bird's eye view, like what is Jacob's story? What does it say about us as people and Nottingham in particular? I forget if this line stayed in the play or not, but this idea that you are quite unique as a perspective because you've been through most of our systems, from education to the court system, to prisons, to probation, to rehabilitation, social services. And you think, well, that as a moral fable, looking at a character walk through our public life and experience it for good or for bad, and often for bad in terms of their flaws, you think there's a real opportunity in there to make sense of the country. But yeah, started off bird's eye, then really loved going down into detail, most of which you provided, Mr. Thanks, you did like half my job, like the richness of your book, Right from Wrong, in terms of the Meadows, street names, specifics about music or what you get from the sweet shop or what you do on your summer holidays. Like, that's great for me because that does...
That is the detail.
That exactly, you, yeah. That puts you, puts you in a place and a time and you start to go, I know what's driving this culture. In terms of process, though, I, at first, restorative justice was something I was painting in quite broad details. It was only then when, probably on like the second draft, when I started sitting down with you over every single line, every single page for those days that we worked together, that's when I started to see the real potential in walking an audience through bit by bit, every single part of that process. And the challenge, and it is always a challenge, but how you make those processes, which don't always sound like the excitement or the action or the adventure or the romance of drama. It sounds quite dry and mechanical, but I get so excited about exploring that, a process of how you do a thing. So working with you, then, you know, speaking with Nicola a lot from Remedy.
Yeah, we had her on there.
Yeah, and her being part of that process as well in the rehearsal room. And she would send me, sometimes via you, a breakdown of how you might run a session or what questions would be. That was great. Like, I properly nailed it down.
And there's
on
definitely
that.
Detail in the language, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. So anything I could make up is nothing compared to, as you say, the specificity of the language, how you conduct yourself, the tone of it and the style of it. And I found it really moving. I think an audience, when they watch, you know, I'm thinking of scenes like when David and Joan start asking you questions and you start answering, and how that was mediated by the character of Nicola and Wendy. The specificity of that, the care that they took, and then ultimately leading to that meeting in the end, and how that was conducted, the planning that had to go into that, the human resource that had to go into that. It felt so authentic because of your work that I think it compelled an audience into normally a closed room that they would never have access to.
Could you relate to any parts or themes within the characters in the play of Punch?
God, yeah, I mean, too many, but like, again, not like you say, not specifically the detail, but...
So I know you said at the beginning of the interview that there were certain things, like when it comes to relationships or other bits that you were like, oh, you know, it's going under the skin.
Well, I think like you articulate very eloquently and beautifully now in grown-up Jacob voice, not early Jacob voice, as we had them in the play, that your realizations and struggles about vulnerability and being allowed to have meaningful conversations with people, whether that be family like your brother or semi-strangers like social workers or even playwrights. That stuff is really hard. And I think for anyone that can be hard if you don't have, to quote you, the like emotional toolkit given to you that allows you to calmly process what you're going through and share that with someone else. You very bravely and honestly talked about how for you as a teenager that would get a release often through violence or acting out or drinking or drugs
or running,
escape rather than facing it, avoiding something rather than looking it in the eye. I completely associate with that, even though I think how I handled it was to retreat into myself and become very... I was an incredibly private person, I would say, for most of my teenage life, well into my 20s, if not even older. It's still something I'm in like dialogue with about struggling to, like if you've spoken to some of my friends at school, they'd probably tell you that they didn't even really know me very well. And I found it very hard to be weak, to not impress people. And I'm sure that's slightly filtered into some of my work addiction, overworking, always wanting to validate myself and impress people, get people to like me by doing probably too many TV dramas, too many plays, because that's my outlet. So I think the very specific detail that I associate with you and your experience is trying to go on a journey where sharing your stuff with people is not a weakness. And I know it's so obvious when you say it out loud and this isn't sophisticated, but addressing the stuff that you push down and sharing that and not avoiding that, I really relate to your story.
So that those shoulders don't have to be so heavy.
So strong. Their shoulders can drop every now and again, and that's great. And I mean, I can't take your version of that is to the extreme in terms of in our story being able to answer the questions of those parents of the people, as you described, that you harmed, and walking into that room and looking in the whites of their eyes. Like, that's a a distilled extreme version of what I've had to go through. But I think why any audience, and possibly that's just, you know, particularly men from a particular class background, why they are moved by your stories, because they see that in themselves and they know the scales of the mountain that you have to climb to get there.
Yeah, we'll touch a bit more on that towards the end of the show, but it's, although it was an extraordinary event, the kind of themes of the play and everything else are quite ordinary to everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's why so many people can access the play through different lenses or characters.
Yeah, whether you're, you know, whether you've lost somebody in your life, or whether you're a mother or a father or a son or a daughter, like those relationships, and dealing with grief or dealing with ambition that's been lost or not met, or even like, I agree, like what's interesting about this play to me is I've written, you know, just thinking of the last ones, Dear England was about a team who invented the oldest game in the world, struggling to conquer the world in these tournaments. So it's got like a huge scale against the backdrop of a global events. Or something like Sherwood, which was about multiple killings against the backdrop of the wounds that opened up during the miners' strike and split countries apart over decades. Not that your story is small, because at the center of it is something devastating and huge for the people involved. But it's a very personal story about you and this family. And often the story, the charm of the story, is about what it feels like to go out on a Saturday night in a market town, or what it feels like to grow up in an estate. And yet talking to people, some people, like I can tell, they feel like it's almost the biggest thing I've written, even though the detail is maybe feels smaller, more local, more personal. I'm trying to sort of assess and understand the scale of people's reaction to it. Because a lot of my family, my friends, reacted like they were saying it's one of their sort of the most meaningful things I've ever written for them. And these are people who see all my West End shows and my musicals. So whatever it is, like it does something, and something really big to people. And, you know, you have to take credit for that, because it's both your journey, but how you understood the power of that story, because that's why you're sharing it. You're sharing it now, you share it in your book, and you share it with offenders and youth groups, because there is something in your story that seems to unlock something with people.
Yeah, it definitely seems to strike a chord with just the common humanity, I guess.
Yeah.
And just like the human condition to like feel. If I was to put it in a nutshell, most people come out of that theatre going, I felt something that I might have been suppressing for a long time.
Yeah.
And I don't know what triggered it, but they come out and it's a hopeful story at the end, although it's difficult, and it's kind of gives people access to something that they might not have accessed for a while. And some people come out and they're like, okay, you know, maybe I need to talk about it.
Yeah.
And think, and to, you know, and that's what we've been trying to facilitate, is like getting people to kind of do that work that I've been trying to do, and lots of people do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And there's something about, I think, forgiveness, which you won't think this because of all your work with the Forgiveness Project and the work that you do. I think to people who don't give it much consideration, there's something about that idea that sounds quite soft or quite woolly or quite easy.
Yeah.
And I think what I've understood in your story and seeing the impact it has on people, like you say, who feel something huge, you can feel it swell through the audience, and you know, people do stifle sobs or burst into tears, because I think it's the very idea of the forgiveness that David and Joan in particular, I should say, offered you in that moment, and that you have allowed yourself to do. I think it just sort of awes people. I think they it makes them sit back and go, Christ, if they can go on that journey, like you say, in my own life, what can I look at that's difficult that I'm ignoring, whether that be a relationship with my father or a relationship with my spouse or things I've kicked down the road. If they can do that, what can I do?
Yeah, that was the challenge I wanted to kind of put to audience members and the general public, was if we can do this, maybe you can resolve, you know, that little spat you had with your brother over the Christmas dinner last year that you haven't spoken with since, you know what I mean, or whatever.
Completely.
So it's fair to say that all the effort paid off, and it kind of went down pretty well. I felt it quite healing at times, because I've been trying to tell my story in different mediums. And this is where the power of the arts and the power of theatre in particular comes in, especially when you have a great writer, is nothing can do it justice the same way a theatre experience can. if done in the right way. Mm. In terms of I've tried a book.
Yeah.
I've tried standing up in front of assemblies. I've done video interviews. I've even sat on the sofa with David and Joan. But what I haven't been able to do is to really make it connect and resonate with audiences. I've had reactions, but yeah. I feel like I've been able to hand it over to this creative team of people and they've done it justice, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Yeah,
that's nice to hear, because I mean, I always advocate for the power of drama that can be Netflix or live stage plays, but particularly being in a live theatre, if people haven't really experienced it in the form of a play, sharing something live with the actors who are sharing the same air as you, and you know, you're meters away from them in some circumstances.
And the stakes are high as well, aren't they?
The stakes are high because it's happening, you can't just cut and go again. It's one sustained piece of action. And, you know, you're in a physical community. There are people around you who you are feeling shake or you hear laugh. The thing it always generates more than any other medium, but particularly like platforms like social media, it creates empathy. It just you are watching somebody go on a journey and you're following them every single way, all their choices, all their footsteps, the impact, the consequence of their behaviors on other characters. And as a human exercise, as a societal exercise, that's what I will always advocate for, it as the best space to kindly and empathetically look at difficult stories, because it just makes you feel so much. But most importantly, it makes you feel so much, not on your own in your bedroom watching a thing, but with hundreds of other people, and something just happens in a room. And I think your story was, for all the pain of it and all the tragedy of it, that's the hope it gives people, because people watch it and they come out having shared this with somebody else.
Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful and been a privilege to be part of it. It's been a privilege to have you on the show. We're coming towards the end of the show. But what is next for you?
Well, this has sort of reminded me why I do it and actually altered some of my views on the kinds of stories I want to tell, possibly less in the rarefied worlds of politics and power and more on the ground of local communities and the crucible of where those decisions get impacted upon people's lives. So community, really, the value of seeing, particularly the Nottingham Playhouse, the value that had on its local audience.
Yeah.
And I remember like being there with you on that opening night and seeing the local MPs and the newly elected mayor of the county and judges and people from the council. And you go, God, this is a real civic moment where people are gathering together to talk about the issues that come from your story. That really excited me. So I think community, basically, that's what I'm going to think about from here on in.
And what does Punch have to say about the state of the nation?
That there is both embedded in the system some deep flaws that have been growing for some time. It's a bit like the rot that builds up in a house that you can try to ignore until it's too late, and so the roof starts coming in. And I think the way that we have treated certain services, particularly on a local level, the things that people really need, social care and youth work, and that the long-term damage of that for short-term, quote-unquote, savings that cost you more in the long term, I think has been one of the biggest disgraces of the past decade or so. And yet also the human capacity for people to still be incredible champions, the people you've interviewed, people like Nicola and Wendy and Sandra, and you, Jacob, who despite that inheritance, somehow rise above and become champions of something that means the world to the people around you. I'm depressed about how things have deteriorated socially and exhausted by what feels like the work that has to be done, but inspired and hopeful by the individuals who are determined to get it done.
Thank you so much, James, for being the incredible person that you are. It's been a pleasure working with you. Looking forward to working with you in the future. And thank you for telling stories and bringing people together. That's probably what I'm most grateful for.
Thank you for allowing me to tell your story. I really appreciate it, mate.
Thanks for being on the show. Next week is a special episode and our last of the season. It's taken from a recording I did on stage at the Nottingham Playhouse with Michael Palin about our reflections on the show and of my story. Be sure to give it a listen. This podcast was produced by One Fine Play. Matt Cheney is series producer Kasra Feruzia is the editor and writer. Thanks also to Selena Christofides for help with the visuals. I have been your host, Jacob Dunn, and this is Right From Wrong.